The jeweller turned the gold slowly over the tiny anvil, tapping the last strangely cut diamond into place.
"From the troll's tooth, you say?"
he muttered, squinting closely at his work.
"Yes," said Cohen. "And as I say, you can have all the rest."
He was fingering a tray of gold rings.
"Very generous," murmured the jeweller, who was dwarvish and knew a good deal when he saw one.
He sighed.
"Not much work lately?"
said Cohen. He looked out through the tiny window and watched a group of empty-eyed people gathered on the other side of the narrow street.
"Times are hard, yes."
"Who are all these guys with the stars painted on?"
said Cohen. The dwarf jeweller didn't look up.
"Madman," he said. "They say I should do no work because the star comes. I tell them stars have never hurt me. I wish I could say the same about people."
Cohen nodded thoughtfully as six men detached themselves from the group and came towards the shop. They were carrying an assortment of weapons and had a driven, determined look about them.
"Strange,"
said Cohen.
"I am, as you can see, one of the dwarvish persuasion," said the jeweller. "One of the magical races, it is said. The star people believe that the star will not destroy the disc if we turn aside from magic. They're probably going to beat me up a bit. So it goes."
He held up his latest work in a pair of tweezers.
"The strangest thing I ever made," he said. "But practical, I can see that. What did you say they were called again?"
"Dinchewers," said Cohen.
He looked at the horseshoe shapes nestling on the wrinkled palm of his hand, then opened his mouth and made a series of painful grunting noises. The door burst open. The men strode in and took up positions around the walls. They were sweating and uncertain, but their leader pushed Cohen aside disdainfully and picked up the dwarf by his shirt.
"We told you yesterday, small stuff," he said. "You go out feet down or feet up, we don't mind. So now we gonna get really—"
Cohen tapped him on the shoulder. The man looked around irritably.
"What do you want, Grandad?"
he snarled. Cohen paused until he had the man's full attention, and then he smiled. It was a slow, lazy smile, unveiling about 300 carats of mouth jewellery that seemed to light up the room.
"I will count to three," he said, in a friendly tone of voice. "One, two—"
His bony knee came up and buried itself in the man's groin with a satisfyingly meaty noise, and he half-turned to bring the full force of an elbow into the kidneys as the leader collapsed around his private universe of pain.
"Three,"
he told the ball of agony on the floor. Cohen had heard of fighting fair and had long ago decided he wanted no part of it. He looked up at the other men and flashed his incredible smile. They ought to have rushed him. Instead, one of them, secure in the knowledge that he had a broadsword and Cohen didn't, sidled crabwise towards him.
"Oh, no," said Cohen, waving his hands. "Oh, come on, lad, not like that."
The man looked sideways at him.
"Not like what?"
he asked suspiciously.
"You never held a sword before."
The man half turned to his colleagues for reassurance.
"Not a lot, no," he said. "Not often."
He waved his sword menacingly. Cohen shrugged.
"I may be going to die, but I should hope I could be killed by a man who could hold his sword like a warrior,"
he said. The man looked at his hands.
"Looks all right,"
he said, doubtfully.
"Look, lad, I know a little about these things. I mean, come here a minute, and do you mind? Right. Your left hand goes here, around the pommel, and your right hand goes—that's right, just here, and the blade goes right into your leg."
As the man screamed and clutched at his foot, Cohen kicked his remaining leg away and turned to the room at large.
"This is getting fiddly," he said. "Why don't you rush me?"
"That's right,"
said a voice by his waist. The jeweller had produced a very large and dirty axe, guaranteed to add tetanus to all the other terrors of warfare. The four men gave these odds some consideration and backed towards the door.
"And wipe those silly stars off," said Cohen. "You can tell everyone that Cohen the Barbarian will be very angry if he sees stars like that again, right?"
The door slammed shut. A moment later the axe thumped into it, bounced off, and took a sliver of leather off the toe of Cohen's sandal.
"Sorry," said the dwarf. "It belonged to my granddad. I only use it for splitting firewood."
Cohen felt his jaw experimentally. The dinchewers seemed to be settling in quite well.
"If I was you, I'd be getting out of here anyway,"
he said. But the dwarf was already scuttling around the room, tipping trays of precious metal and gems into a leather sack. A roll of tools went into one pocket, a packet of finished jewellery went into another, and with a grunt the dwarf stuck his arms through the handles on either side of his little forge and heaved it bodily onto his back.
"Right," he said, "I'm ready."
"You're coming with me?"
"As far as the city gates, if you don't mind," he said. "You can't blame me, can you?"
"No, but leave the axe behind."
They stepped out into the afternoon sun and a deserted street. When Cohen opened his mouth, little pinpoints of bright light illuminated all the shadows.
"I've got some friends round here to pick up," he said, and added, "I hope they're all right. What's your name?"
"Lackjaw."
"Is there anywhere around here where I can..."
Cohen paused lovingly, savouring the words.
"Where I can get a steak?"
"The Star people have closed all the inns. They said it's wrong to be eating and drinking when..."
I know, said Cohen. "I think I'm beginning to get the hang of it. Don't they approve of anything?"
Lackjaw was lost in thought for a moment.
Setting fire to things," he said at last. "They're quite good at that. Books and stuff. They have these great big bonfires."
Cohen was shocked.
"Bonfires of books?"
"Yes. Horrible, isn't it?"
"Right,"
said Cohen. He thought it was appalling. Someone who spent his life living rough under the sky knew the value of a good thick book, which ought to outlast at least a season of cooking fires if you were careful how you tore the pages out. Many a life had been saved on a snowy night by a handful of sodden kindling and a really dry book. If you felt like a smoke and couldn't find a pipe, a book was your man every time. Cohen realised people wrote things in books. It had always seemed to him to be a frivolous waste of paper.
"I'm afraid if your friends met them, they might be in trouble," Lackjaw said sadly as they walked up the street.
They turned the corner and saw the bonfire. It was in the middle of the street. A couple of Star people were feeding it with books from a nearby house, which had its door smashed in and had been daubed with stars. News of Cohen hadn't spread too far yet. The book burners took no notice as he wandered up and leaned against the wall. Curly flakes of burnt paper bounced in the hot air and floated away over the rooftops.
"What are you doing?" he said.
One of the Star people, a woman, pushed her hair out of her eyes with a soot-blackened hand, gazed intently at Cohen's left ear, and said,
"Ridding the disk of wickedness."
Two men came out of the building and glared at Cohen, or at least at his ear. Cohen reached out and took the heavy book the woman was carrying. Its cover was crusted with strange red and black stones that spelled out what Cohen was sure was a word. He showed it to Lackjaw.
"The Necrotelecomnicon," said the dwarf. "Wizards use it. It's how to contact the dead, I think."
"That's wizards for you," said Cohen.
He felt a page between a finger and thumb. It was thin and quite soft. The rather unpleasant organic-looking writing didn't worry him at all. Yes, a book like this could be a real friend to a man.
"Yes, you want something?"
he said to one of the Star men who had gripped his arm.
"All books of magic must be burned," said the man,
but a little uncertainly, because something about Cohen's teeth was giving him a nasty feeling of sanity.
"Why?" said Cohen.
"It has been revealed to us."
Now Cohen's smile was as wide as all outdoors, and rather more dangerous.
"I think we ought to be getting along," said Lackjaw nervously.
A party of Star people had turned into the street behind them.
"I think I would like to kill someone," said Cohen, still smiling.
"The Star directs that the disk must be cleansed," said the man, backing away.
"Stars can't talk," said Cohen, drawing his sword.
"If you kill me, 1,000 will take my place," said the man, who was now backed against the wall.
"Yes," said Cohen, in a reasonable tone of voice, "but that isn't the point, is it? The point is, you'll be dead."
The man's Adam's apple began to bob like a yo-yo. He squinted down at Cohen's sword.
"There is that, yes," he conceded. "Tell you what, how about if we put the fire out?"
"Good idea," said Cohen.
Lackjaw tugged at his belt. The other Star people were running towards them. There were a lot of them. Many of them were armed, and it began to look as though things would become a little more serious.
Cohen waved his sword at them defiantly and turned and ran. Even Lackjaw had difficulty keeping up.
"Funny," he gasped, as they plunged down another alley. "I thought, for a minute, you'd want to stand and fight them.
Blow that, for a lark."
As they came out into the light at the other end of the alley, Cohen flung himself against the wall, drew his sword, stood with his head on one side as he judged the approaching footsteps, and then brought the blade around in a dead flat sweep at stomach height. There was an unpleasant noise and several screams, but by then Cohen was well away up the street, moving in the unusual shambling run that spared his bunions. With Lackjaw pounding along grimly beside him, he turned off into an inn painted with red stars, jumped onto a table with only a faint whimper of pain, ran along it, while, with almost perfect choreography, Lackjaw ran straight underneath without ducking, jumped down at the other end, kicked his way through the kitchens, and came out into another alley. They scurried around a few more turnings and piled into a doorway. Cohen clung to the wall and wheezed until the little blue and purple lights went away.
"Well," he panted, "what did you get?"
"The cruet," said Lackjaw.
"Just that?"
"Well, I had to go under the table, didn't I? You didn't do so well yourself."
Cohen looked disdainfully at the small melon he had managed to skewer in his flight.
"Things must be pretty tough here," he said, biting through the rind.
"Want some salt on it?" said the dwarf.
Cohen said nothing. He just stood holding the melon with his mouth open. Lackjaw looked around. The cul-de-sac they were in was empty except for an old box someone had left against a wall. Cohen was staring at it. He handed the melon to the dwarf without looking at him and walked out into the sunlight. Lackjaw watched him creep stealthily around the box, or as stealthily as is possible with joints that creaked like a ship under full sail, and prod it once or twice with his sword, but very gingerly, as if he half expected it to explode.
"It's just a box," the dwarf called out. "What's so special about a box?"
Cohen said nothing. He squatted down painfully and peered closely at the lock on the lid.
"What's in it?" said Lackjaw.
"You wouldn't want to know," said Cohen. "Help me up, will you?"
"Yes, but this box..."
"This box," said Cohen, "this box is..."
He waved his arms vaguely.
"Oblong?"
"Eldritch," said Cohen mysteriously.
"Eldritch?"
"Yep."
"Oh,"
said the dwarf. They stood looking at the box for a moment.
"Cohen?"
"Yes?"
"What does Eldritch mean?"
"Well, Eldritch is..."
Cohen paused and looked down irritably.
"Give it a kick and you'll see."
Lockjaw's steel-capped dwarf boot whammed into the side of the box. Cohen flinched. Nothing else happened.
"I see," said the dwarf. "Eldritch means wooden."
"No," said Cohen. It oughtn't to have done that."
"I see," said Lackjaw,
who didn't, and was beginning to wish Cohen hadn't gone out into all this hot sunlight.
"It ought to have run away, you think?"
"Yes, or bitten your leg off."
"Ah,"
said the dwarf. He took Cohen gently by the arm.
"It's nice and shady over here," he said. "Why don't you just have a little..."
Cohen shook him off.
"It's watching that wall," he said. "Look, that's why it's not taking any notice of us. It's staring at the wall."
"Yes, that's right," said Lackjaw soothingly. "Of course it's watching that little wall with its little eyes."
"Don't be an idiot. It hasn't got any eyes," snapped Cohen.
"Oh, sorry, sorry,"
said Lackjaw hurriedly.
"It's watching the wall without eyes. Sorry."
"I think it's worried about something," said Cohen.
"Well, it would be, wouldn't it?" said Lackjaw. "I expect it just wants us to go off somewhere and leave it alone."
"I think it's very puzzled," Cohen added.
"Yes, it certainly looks puzzled," said the dwarf.
Cohen glared at him.
"How can you tell?" he snapped.
It struck Lackjaw that the roles were unfairly reversing. He looked from Cohen to the box, his mouth opening and shutting.
"How can you tell?" he said.
But Cohen wasn't listening anyway. He sat down in front of the box, assuming that the bit with the keyhole was the front, and watched it intently. Lackjaw backed away.
"Funny," said his mind, "but the damn thing is looking at me."
"All right," said Cohen. "I know you and me don't see eye to eye, but we're all trying to find someone we care for, okay?"
"I'm..."
said Lackjaw, and realised that Cohen was talking to the box.
So tell me where they've gone.
As Lackjaw looked on in horror, the luggage extended its little legs, braced itself, and ran full tilt at the nearest wall. Clay, bricks, and dusty mortar exploded around it. Cohen peered through the hole. There was a small, grubby storeroom on the other side of it. The luggage stood in the middle of the floor, radiating extreme bafflement.
"Sharp," said Twoflower. "Anyone here?" said Bethan.
"Oh," said Rincewind.
"I think we ought to sit him down somewhere and get him a glass of water," said Twoflower, "if there's one here." "There's everything else," said Bethan.
The room was full of shelves, and the shelves were full of everything. Things that couldn't be accommodated on them hung in bunches from the dark and shadowy ceiling. Boxes and sacks of everything spilled onto the floor. There was no sound from outside. Bethan looked around and found out why.
"I've never seen so much stuff," said Twoflower.
"There's one thing it's out of stock of," said Bethan firmly.
"How can you tell?"
"You just have to look. It's fresh out of exits."
Twoflower turned around. Where the door and window had been, there were shelves stacked with boxes. They looked as though they'd been there for a long time. Twoflower sat Rincewind down on a rickety chair by the counter and poked doubtfully at the shelves. There were boxes of nails and hairbrushes. There were bars of soap faded with age. There was a stack of jars containing deliquescent bath salts, to which someone had fixed a rather sad and jaunty little notice announcing, in the face of all the evidence, that one would make an ideal gift. There was also quite a lot of dust. Bethan peered at the shelves on the other wall and laughed.
"Would you look at this?" she said.
Twoflower looked. She was holding, well, it was a little mountain chalet, but with seashells stuck all over it, and then the perpetrator had written, "A special souvenir," in pokerwork on the roof, which of course opened so that cigarettes could be kept in it, and played a tinny little tune.
"Have you ever seen anything like it?" she said.
Twoflower shook his head. His mouth dropped open.
"Are you all right?" said Bethan.
"I think it's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen," he said. There was a whirring noise overhead. They looked up. A big black globe had lowered itself from the darkness of the ceiling. Little red lights flashed on and off on it, and as they stared it spun around and looked at them with a big glass eye. It was menacing, that eye. It seemed to suggest very emphatically that it was watching something distasteful.
"Hello," said Twoflower.
A head appeared over the edge of the counter. It looked angry.
"I hope you were intending to pay for that," it said nastily.
Its expression suggested that it expected Rincewind to say yes, and that it wouldn't believe him.
"This?" said Bethan. "I wouldn't buy this if you threw in a hat full of rubies, and I'll buy it."
"How much?" said Twoflower, urgently reaching into his pockets. His face fell.
"Actually, I haven't got any money," he said. "It's in my luggage, but I..."
There was a snort. The head disappeared from behind the counter and reappeared from behind a display of toothbrushes. It belonged to a very small man, almost hidden behind a green apron. He seemed very upset.
"No money," he said. "You come into my shop."
"We didn't mean to," said Twoflower quickly. "We didn't notice it was there."
"It wasn't," said Bethan firmly. "It's magical, isn't it?" The small shopkeeper hesitated.
"Yes," he reluctantly agreed. "A bit."
"A bit?" said Bethan. "A bit magical."
"Quite a bit, then," he conceded, backing away, and...
"All right," he agreed, as Bethan continued to glare at him.
"It's magical. I can't help it. The bloody door hasn't been and gone again, has it?"
"Yes, and we're not happy about that thing in the ceiling."
He looked up and frowned. Then he disappeared through a little beaded doorway, half hidden among the merchandise. There was a lot of clanking and whirring, and the black globe disappeared into the shadows. It was replaced by, in succession, a bunch of herbs, a mobile advertising something Twoflower had never heard of, but which was apparently a bedtime drink, a suit of armour, and a stuffed crocodile with a lifelike expression of extreme pain and surprise. The shopkeeper reappeared.
"Better?"
he demanded.
"It's an improvement," said Twoflower doubtfully. "I liked the herbs best."
At this point, Rincewind groaned. He was about to wake up. There have been three general theories put forward to explain the phenomenon of the wandering shops, or, as they're generically known, tabernae vagantes. The first postulates that many thousands of years ago there evolved somewhere in the multiverse a race whose single talent was to buy cheap and sell dear. Soon they controlled a vast galactic empire, or as they put it, emporium, and the more advanced members of the species found a way to equip their very shops with unique propulsion units that could break the dark walls of space itself and open up vast new markets. And long after the worlds of the emporium perished in the heat death of their particular universe, after one last defiant fire sale, the wandering star shops still ply their trade, eating their way through the pages of space-time like a worm through a three-volume novel. The second is that they are the creation of a sympathetic fate, charged with the role of supplying exactly the right thing at the right time. The third is that they are simply a very clever way of getting around the various Sunday closing acts. All these theories, diverse as they are, have two things in common. They explain the observed facts, and they're completely and utterly wrong. Rincewind opened his eyes and lay for a moment looking up at the stuffed reptile. It was not the best thing to see when awakening from troubled dreams. Magic. So that's what it felt like. No wonder wizards didn't have much truck with sex. Rincewind knew what orgasms were, of course. He'd had a few in his time, sometimes even in company, but nothing in his experience even approximated to that tight, hot moment when every nerve in his body streamed with blue-white fire and raw magic had blazed forth from his fingers. It filled you and lifted you, and you surfed down the rising, curling wave of elemental force. No wonder wizards fought for power. And so on. The spell in his head had been doing it, though, not Rincewind. He was really beginning to hate that spell. He was sure that if it hadn't frightened away all the other spells he'd tried to learn, he could have been a decent wizard in his own right. Somewhere in Rincewind's battered soul, the worm of rebellion flashed a fang. Right, he thought. You're going back into the Octavo first chance I get. He sat up. Where the hell is this? He said, grabbing his head to stop it exploding. A shop, said Two Flower mournfully. I hope it sells knives, because I think I'd like to cut my head off, said Rincewind. Something about the expression of the two opposite him sobered him up. That was a joke, he said. Mainly a joke, anyway. Why are we in this shop?
We can't get out, said Bethan.
The door's disappeared, added Two Flower helpfully. Rincewind stood up a little shakily. Oh, he said. One of those shops?
All right, said the shopkeeper testily. It's magical, yes, it moves around, yes. No, I'm not telling you why.
Can I have a drink of water, please? Said Rincewind.
The shopkeeper looked affronted. First no money, then they want a glass of water, he snapped. That's just about...
Bethan snorted and strode across to the little man, who tried to back away. He was too late. She picked him up by his apron straps and glared at him eye to eye. Torn though her dress was, disarrayed though her hair was, she became for a moment the symbol of every woman who has caught a man with his thumb on the scales of life.
"Time is money," she hissed. "I'll give you 30 seconds to give him a glass of water. I think that's a bargain, don't you?" "I say," Two Flower whispered, "she's a real terror when she's roused, isn't she?"
"Yes," said Rincewind, without enthusiasm.
"All right, all right," said the shopkeeper, visibly cowed. "And then you can let us out." "That's fine by me. I wasn't open for business anyway. I just stopped for a few seconds to get my bearings and you barged in."
He grumbled off through the bead curtains and returned with a cup of water.
"I washed it out special," he said, avoiding Bethan's gaze.
Rincewind looked at the liquid in the cup. It had probably been clean before it was poured in. Now, drinking it would be genocide for thousands of innocent germs. He put it down carefully.
"Now I'm going to have a good wash," stated Bethan, and stalked off through the curtain.
The shopkeeper waved a hand vaguely and looked appealingly at Rincewind and Two Flower.
"She's not bad," said Two Flower. "She's going to marry a friend of ours."
"Does he know?" "Things not so good in the star shop business," said Rincewind, as sympathetically as he could manage. The little man shuddered.
"You wouldn't believe it," he said. "I mean, you learn not to expect much. You make a sale here and there. It's a living, you know what I mean? But these people you've got these days, the ones with these star things painted on their faces, well, I hardly have time to open the store, and they're threatening to burn it down.
Too magical, they say. So I say, of course magical. What else?
Are there a lot of them about, then? Said Rincewind.
All over the disk, friend. Don't ask me why.
They believe a star is going to crash into the disk, said Rincewind.
Is it?
Lots of people think so.
That's a shame. I've done good business here. Too magical, they say. What's wrong with magic? That's what I'd like to know.
What will you do? Said Two Flower.
Ah, go to some other universe. There's plenty around, said the shopkeeper airily. Thanks for telling me about the star, though. Can I drop you off somewhere?
The spell gave Rincewind's mind a kick. No, he said. I think perhaps we'd better stay to see it through, you know?
You're not worried about this star thing, then?
The star is life, not death, said Rincewind.
How's that?
How's what?
You did it again, said Two Flower, pointing an accusing finger. You say things and then don't know you've said them.
I just said we'd better stay, said Rincewind.
You said the star was life, not death, said Two Flower. Your voice went all crackly and far away, didn't it? He turned to the shopkeeper for confirmation.
That's true, said the little man. I thought his eyes crossed a bit, too.
It's the spell, then, said Rincewind. It's trying to take me over. It knows what's going to happen, and I think it wants to go to Ankh-Morpork. I want to go, too, he added defiantly. Can you take us there?
Is that the big city on the Ankh? Sprawling place? Smells of cesspits?
It has an ancient and honourable history, said Rincewind, his voice stiff with injured civic pride.
That's not how you described it to me, said Two Flower. You told me it was the only city that actually started out decadent.
Rincewind looked embarrassed.
Yes, but, well, it's my home, don't you see?
No, said the shopkeeper, not really. I always say home is where you hang your hat.
No, said Two Flower, always anxious to enlighten. Where you hang your hat is a hat stand. A home is...
I'll just go and see about setting you on your way, said the shopkeeper hurriedly, as Bethan came in. He scooted past her.
Two Flower followed him. On the other side of the curtain was a room with a small bed, a rather grubby stove, and a three-legged table. Then the shopkeeper did something to the table. There was a noise like a cork coming reluctantly out of a bottle, and the room contained a wall-to-wall universe.
"Don't be frightened," said the shopkeeper, as stars streamed past.
"I'm not frightened," said Two Flower, his eyes sparkling.
"Oh," said the shopkeeper, slightly annoyed. "Anyway, it's just imagery generated by the shop. It's not real."
"And you can go anywhere?"
"Oh, no," said the shopkeeper, deeply shocked. "There's all kinds of fail-safes built in. After all, there'd be no point in going somewhere with insufficient per capita disposable income. And there's got to be a suitable wall, of course."
Ah, here we are. This is your universe.
Very bijou, I always think. A sort of universette,